Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. On November 8th, 2018, a fast-moving campfire ravaged Paradise, a community of almost 27,000 people nestled in the foothills of California's Sierra Nevada mountains. The deadly campfire forced thousands of residents to flee, killed 85 people, and burned more than 150,000 acres, making it the worst fire in California's history. In Paradise, 95% of the businesses and 90% of the homes were destroyed. That's about 11,000. In her new book, Paradise, One Town's Struggle to Survive an American Wildfire, journalist Lizzie Johnson writes about the people whose lives were forever changed. She also investigates the root causes, from the climate crisis to PG&E's decades-long neglect of critical infrastructure. The campfire ignited from a malfunctioning PG&E transmission line. That morning, a threadbare hook on the century-old tower snapped, and this was entirely preventable. A replacement would have cost just $19. Lizzie Johnson's new book is the product of more than 500 interviews and years of full-time wildfire coverage. She even enrolled in a professional firefighting academy to better understand fire. Lizzie Johnson is a staff writer with the Washington Post. She previously worked at the San Francisco Chronicle, where she reported on 15 of the deadliest and most destructive blazes in modern California history. Her new book is called Paradise, One Town's Struggle to Survive an American Wildfire. Hi, Lizzie, thanks so much for joining us and congratulations on your book.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, we've done so many shows about Paradise, but what makes your book so unique is that you go so deep and write in detail about so many of the people you met along the way of your reporting journey. As you write on Twitter, almost 3 years ago, your editor called you early one November morning and said, "A wildfire has sparked near a town called Paradise. Could you go?" And that began your journey. So why did you decide to write a book about Paradise?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like you mentioned, I'd been covering fires for a couple of years when the wildfire sparked near Paradise. And so, you know, when I went up there, I realized that the story was just too big to fit in a newspaper. You know, I wrote article after article, and it still didn't seem like it was doing the place justice in the way that I wanted it to. And so at that point, I was like, well, I think the natural next step is to just turn this into a book.
Like I said, you write in such great detail about the people that you met. In some ways, it's almost like fiction because the detail is so rich. Why did you decide to take that, use that method?
I've always been really obsessive about reporting. I think, you know, anyone that's read some of my bigger projects in the San Francisco Chronicle, they'll know that I really take the time to get to know my subjects and dive really, really deep into the reporting part. I think that's how you take something that feels so abstract, like the state's most destructive wildfire, and turn it into something that feels really personal, right? Like that's how you get people to care when you know, you know, it just wasn't a big fire, that this was the fire that burned down this one house. And in that one house was this one Bible that had been in the family for 97 years or something like that. I really just wanted people to care. And the best way to do that is by really showing them the lives that were impacted by this fire.
It is such a good point, because as we are dealing with so many fires in California, you kind of lose track. Where are they? How many are burning right now? I mean, even reading these statistics about the campfire burning 150,000 acres, 95% of businesses, 90% of homes have been lost. These are just numbers, but your book, you dedicate your book to the memory of Phil John, who believed in Paradise, even and especially when it was ruined. Can you just tell us a little bit about Phil John?
Yeah, Phil was really special. He was one of the first people that I met in Paradise. He was the chair of the local Fire Safe Council. And, you know, I was an outsider coming into his town, like so many journalists that morning. And he really took the time to explain to me what Paradise had been and what its people were like, and was really gracious in introducing me to all sorts of people in the community. And then you know, in the year after, year and a half, when I was reporting the book, he just constantly was my gut check when I was like, hey, what do you think about this? Or trying to understand how things worked. And so he was like the ambassador of that town and really was emblematic of its people. And he sadly passed away of a heart attack. And it was a really, really awful loss for the people of Paradise. And so I just felt like the book needed to be dedicated to him, to his memory, and to what he represented.
The other thing you write about on Twitter, Lizzie, is that you'd been covering fires for a while, writing about the ways in which these disasters lived on even after the flames had gone cold. You write, I thought I knew fire. California thought it knew fire, but nobody could have been prepared for what we saw in Paradise.
It, you know, the fires in California and across the greater West have changed so much in the past few years. You know, there was a time when it was a big deal when one house or one neighborhood burned down. And so, you know, I had been covering really awful fires up until 2018. I covered the wine country fires of 2017. I covered the car fire that spawned that fire tornado near the city of Redding. And so I sort of had this idea of how bad it could be. But never once did I imagine a fire actually taking out an entire town. And I think there were a lot of people across California who, you know, realized in an abstract way that, you know, maybe that could hypothetically happen. But when you're seeing it for the first time, you suddenly realize just how violent it can be and what we stand to lose.
I mean, even watching the video clips on your Twitter feed are still really shocking for even those of us who've lived here for a long time to see just how fast this fire moved in Paradise is still to this day so shocking. I mean, it's incredible to think that this fire nearly wiped the town of Paradise off the map in just 4 hours.
It's insane. And as part of my reporting, I collected as many photos and videos as I could. And so I remember seeing those videos from early on the morning of November 8th, and the wind just, like, it looked like it could knock a man over. It was blowing so, so hard. The town of Paradise never stood a chance. Neither did Magalia or Concow, the two other communities nearby. The fire just outpaced every effort by firefighters to contain them until they realized that there was just nothing they could do at all.
Lizzie, as a reporter who has covered so many fires, and you do such great reporting on this really important issue, what are your thoughts on how to tell this story? Because you've got, and we'll talk about this in detail, but you've got information about the First Peoples of Paradise, and we'll talk about that, and how they really managed fire. And then you had the settlers come in. They thought fire was evil, and so it was like, put fires out at any cost as soon as possible, and we've paid such a dear price for that. And then you have the logging industry and what they have done to the land, which contributes to these ferocious fires. You've got the climate crisis. As you write in your book, there are innocuous mishaps like a golf club or a lawnmower striking a rock, a trailer dragging against the asphalt could start a blaze. But then you have PG&E, the largest power provider in California, experimenting with shutting off power when high risk was forecast. And sadly, the campfire ignited tragically from a malfunctioning PG&E transmission line. And we'll talk about that. But given all these different layers, how do you tell stories about fires in California?
I see my job as holding up a mirror to the problem, helping people understand what these fires actually mean, aside from, you know, the statistics, like you were saying, when you're looking at those lists of the biggest fire, the most destructive fire, the deadliest fire, they all start to kind of run together. And I think it's easy to stop caring, because you just get tired, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I view my work and my reporting as getting people to continue to care, even when they think they know the story. So for example, after the campfire, one of my favorite stories I got to work on was how the local ballet studio, which had burned down, managed to put on their production of The Nutcracker, even though it was a month late, even though the girl who was supposed to play the Sugar Plum Fairy moved away, even though all of the kids had no costumes and no homes, they still managed to pull it together with donations. And so it's stories like that, I think, that really show how these fires live on and why they matter.
This is a good point, especially for those of us who live in cities, who might not directly come into contact with fires, but of course know people who do. And it's a case where we check the air quality on a regular basis and decide what mask to use, or should we go outside? I mean, we've done so many shows about horrible air quality, but I think you make a good point about how this is happening so much that you almost feel kind of disconnected from it. And as you write, it changes people's lives, and the trauma of dealing with a fire lasts for years and years after the fact, especially in a community like Paradise, where you have the average resident, 55 years old, a quarter of the community had a disability, and we'll talk about this in detail. The Paradise Unified School District had among the highest number of students with adverse childhood experience in the state, traumatized by abuse, poverty, addiction, or alcoholism. You know, it's a very poor community. They rely on Social Security. So a community like this, the after effects are just, I mean, how do you even begin to, you know, understand that?
Right. You know, it's all of those things, the lack of resources. Some people just can't afford to rebuild a life. And so a fire like this changes everything for them forever. And in addition to that, you have to remember that Paradise was also a really tight-knit community. And so even beyond the buildings that burned, there is that collective sense of safety and identity that is gone. You know, there are people who lived in that town for generations. They have mountains in their blood, and they lost all of that. You know, it's not just always one person's decision, you know, do we rebuild? Do we not rebuild? Where do we go? But what happens when you have an entire family that used to live down the block from each other, and now all of a sudden people are scattering? Fire has a really dramatic effect on people's lives. And I think that's why we need to heed it and pay attention, because there's this sense that things sort of go back to normal after a year or two. You'll read the stories about the anniversary and then not really hear about it anymore. And I think that's doing a disservice to these places.
In a community like Paradise, as you write, the number of senior citizens made the threat exponentially greater. Compared to the general population, elderly adults were twice as likely to die or be injured in a blaze.
Yeah, that was a really, really big problem in Paradise. And if you look at the list of victims, the people who died, a lot of them are older. There was one woman in particular who I spend a lot of time thinking about. She was 99 years old, and she was found on her front porch next to her wheelchair. Mm. And she was only a few months away from her 100th birthday, right? These are like a really vulnerable demographic. They just don't have the ability to always escape quickly. If you even think about the fact that, you know, when the power went out, garage doors wouldn't open. And so these people might not have had the strength to manually open their garage and escape. And so they were trapped as the fire rolled through their town.
I was really struck by Sarah Magnuson's story, and also the CAL FIRE dispatcher Beth Bowersock, because she had to answer so many calls and she couldn't help people. As you write, CAL FIRE dispatcher Beth Bowersock recognized the voice on the line as soon as she picked up the call. Her neighbor Sarah Magnuson had called 911 hundreds of times during her slow slide into dementia. At one point, she was ringing the emergency line 10 to 12 times a day, complaining of chest pain or claiming a burglar was breaking into her house. The 75-year-old loved Christmas and kept twinkle lights strung along her eaves year-round. One strand draped across the front door tapped the frame when the wind blew, making it sound as if someone was working the lock. Can you tell us about Sarah Magnuson and what happened to her that day?
Yeah, so Sarah, unfortunately, was one of the people who didn't make it out of the fire alive. And, you know, she lived alone. Her husband had died in recent years, and she was struggling with dementia, so didn't always have a good grasp on reality. And so when that fire started, she didn't understand the risk. She didn't understand that she needed to leave. And, you know, even if she did, she didn't own a car, so she wouldn't have had a clear way to escape. And so Sarah's story is just really indicative of so many people that morning who couldn't make it out they didn't have time or they didn't have people to check on them. And, you know, those are the people who are most at risk during these natural disasters. And it's just horrifying to hear their stories. As part of reporting this book, I went through and listened to every single 911 call that came in that morning. And there were so many people like Sarah who called expecting someone to be able to help them, hoping that someone could come and help them. But that help never came.
And like I said, the CAL FIRE dispatcher, Beth Bowersox, to think of the trauma that she experienced, as you write, people called 911 expecting first responders to save them, but more and more on that this grim morning, there was nothing they could do. After a few minutes of talking to Sarah, Bowersox wiped the tears from her cheeks. She had no choice. Gulping back sobs, she put on her headset and answered another call from another person she couldn't help. I mean, this is just devastating to think about, Lizzie, that people were calling in desperation and yet she couldn't do anything to help them.
Yeah, all they could do was try and tell them to get out of the house, to run, to get help. But, you know, when someone calls in, there is only so much you can do. And for Beth Bowersox, that was a really personal call to get because Sarah was her neighbor. She lived across the street from her in Paradise. And so, you know, that is the kind of trauma that lives on in people too. Mm. And Beth also wasn't the only dispatcher getting calls like that that morning. There was another dispatcher. I remember this call so well. There was a house of three generations of women. It was a grandmother, a mother, and her granddaughter. And they called 911 hoping someone would be able to come and save them. And over the dispatcher told them, you know, can you open a window? Can you try and walk down the front steps? Can you kick a hole through the wall? But the women were disabled and couldn't move. And that poor dispatcher essentially had to listen to them die on the phone. Mm.
I mean, this just brings up so many questions around how local, state, and federal officials, you know, what they are doing to help the most vulnerable. I mean, air quality itself, we did a show a couple months ago basically saying, okay, we need to ensure that officials get people the air filtration and the masks that they need, because we know that a cloth mask is not going to protect you from smoke. You have to get an N95. But to go further than that, in this case, have you talked to politicians about what they are doing to ensure that the most vulnerable have the information that they need? I mean, we'll talk about getting the message out, but you know, have the information they need to get out and what we need to do as a society to ensure that we reach the most vulnerable.
Yeah. You know, I always wish I had answers for how to fix these problems, because the consequences are so horrifying. But all I can really do as a journalist is hold the mirror up and show why it matters and why we need to pay attention. I can say that officials have really encouraged personal preparedness, making sure that, you know, if you live in a fire-prone area, that you have a list of contacts you can call for help if a fire breaks out and you know you can't get out. But again, that doesn't always help people who, you know, might be isolated, might not have close friends or family nearby. And it's the kind of thing that I think policymakers are still trying to figure out. And unfortunately, there isn't a good answer yet.
Today, we're speaking with Lizzie Johnson, staff writer at The Washington Post. She previously worked at the San Francisco Chronicle, where she reported on 15 of the deadliest, largest, and most destructive blazes in modern California history. Her new book is Paradise, One Town's Struggle to Survive an American Wildfire. Lizzie's new book is the product of more than 500 interviews and years of full-time wildfire coverage. She even enrolled in a professional firefighting academy to better understand fire. If you have any questions for Lizzie about California's fires and what she learned, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on where we are right now with the fires in California? Every day changes when it comes to air quality. If you live in an area that is fire prone, what steps have you taken? What are you hearing from your local and state politicians? What changes would you like to see? now that this is happening on a regular basis. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. So let's talk about what officials are doing to get messages out. As you write, in Paradise, in the sheriff's office, there were five people who were trained to send emergency messages using code red. Of them, only one person, an information systems analyst, had shown up for work. The rest were out of town or tending to their families. The analyst now struggled to field all the incoming phone calls, with two people calling in with identical requests. The Code Red system was owned by the California-based software company OnSolve, which maintained 12 data centers around the world and billed itself as the nation's number one public safety alerting solutions. So Lizzie, can you tell us more about this Code Red system?
Yeah, so Code Red was the system that Butte County had used to alert people of emergencies. It was a voluntary sign-up system. So basically, you would go online, make an account, and give them your phone number or your email. And if there was a flood or a tornado warning or a fire, the county or the town of Paradise would notify you. But obviously, it's a very imperfect system in that if you didn't sign up, you would not get those alerts, and not everyone had the wherewithal to realize that they needed to sign up. In addition to that, it was really vulnerable to disasters like the Camp Fire, which hit Paradise on November 8th, 2018. When that fire came through, it knocked out a bunch of cell towers and melted the fiber optic cables between them. So the system became really overloaded, and the local government struggled to get those messages out. At the same time, there was a second system that they tried to use. That's that Amber Alert style system. And it goes out to every single phone in a geographic area, regardless of whether people have signed up. And so experts have said, you know, that's the better way to do it when a natural disaster happens and you really need to keep people informed. But on that day, the Butte County Sheriff's Office, there was an issue, a malfunction. And so that alert never went out. They had never tested the system before, and they didn't even realize for a couple of days that the Amber Alert didn't send. So obviously there were a lot of issues with keeping people informed as the fire was barreling towards the towns of Concow, Magalia, and Paradise.
And as you report, a number of people basically called and asked dispatchers, are we supposed to be evacuated or what? And in one instance, a Paradise police dispatcher, Carol Ladrini, hadn't received an order. And she said, no, you'll be notified. There's a fire north of Concow up off Highway 70. No danger to Paradise. Okay. And then there was a back and forth. So how many people actually did receive an emergency alert from the system?
Right. You know, when you're looking at that data, only a fraction of people ever actually got an alert to evacuate their homes. It was partly because, you know, the system didn't work the way it was supposed to. And it was partly because that fire was so big and so fast that the chain of communication sort of broke down. Even the firefighters that were at the start of the fire couldn't really figure out where it was at. And so it's really hard to tell people, you know, it's time to leave your home when you don't even know if the fire is at their home yet. And so that lended itself to exchanges like the one you just mentioned with the Paradise police officer talking to a woman on the 911 line who knew that she needed to evacuate her home, but she had found that out before the Paradise police officer had. So there was a lot of confusion and a lot of people didn't know what to do. Mm.
You write that a year before, the state had been confronted with the grave consequences of not alerting residents in a timely manner. When the Wine Country wildfires blazed through Sonoma County in 2017, only 2% of residents had been signed up for its primary warning system, SOCO Alert, S-O-C-O Alert. Only 2%. And as you write, State Senators Mike McGuire and Bill Dodd, whose districts were most impacted, brought a bill to the Capitol. They wanted to pass a uniform protocol for how all 58 counties in California issued emergency notifications. The bill passed in September 2018, but as of November 2018, the protocol was still being drafted. So where are we today with these emergency alerts?
Yeah, you know, I haven't been following them as much recently, but it continues to be a problem across the state of California in that we haven't figured out a perfect way to tell people when it's time to evacuate their homes, and the systems that are set up don't always work. That's something that is still in the process of being perfected and figured out. What's the best way to get people moving when a fire happens?
So do you have any advice based on the reporting you've done for people who do live in areas that are prone to fires? What is the best way for them to get on this system so they could get the most up-to-date information?
I think the best thing to realize is that if you live in a fire-prone place, it can be really easy to self-comfort and say, oh, it won't happen here. My house will be fine. Fire will never take out my community. And more, that's just something that people don't have the privilege of actually believing, because more and more places are going to be impacted. So the best thing that you can do is to have a go bag ready. For those of you who don't know, that's basically just having a bag of your most important documents, family photos, that kind of thing stashed by the front door near your garage. That way, if you need to leave your home in a rush, everything is there and you can just go. Also, making sure that you're signed up for your community's emergency notification platform, whatever that is. And also having a plan, you know, sitting down with your family and thinking, okay, if we do have to evacuate in the middle of the night, where are we going to go? What is our meeting point? Are we going to go to this nearby city and try and find a hotel? Which hotel? It's a lot easier when you're panicked and going through a disaster. When you have a plan and you know what to do, it makes it a lot easier to just get out safely.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Lizzie Johnson, staff writer with the Washington Post, who previously worked with the San Francisco Chronicle. Lizzie has reported on 15 of the deadliest, largest, and most destructive blazes in modern California history. And she's the author of the new book, Paradise, One Town's Struggle to Survive an American Wildfire. On November 8th, 2018, the fast-moving campfire nearly wiped the town of Paradise off the map in just 4 hours. Lizzie Johnson interviewed more than 500 people for this book and spent years reporting on wildfire coverage. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the First Peoples of Paradise and how they dealt with fires. And then we're going to spend a lot of time on what Lizzie learned about PG&E. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Lizzie Johnson about her new book, Paradise, One Town's Struggle to Survive an American Wildfire. Lizzie Johnson is a staff writer with the Washington Post. She previously worked at the San Francisco Chronicle, where she extensively reported on 15 of the deadliest, largest, and most destructive blazes in modern California history. If you have any questions or comments for Lizzie about Paradise, about California's wildfire crisis, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. Lizzie, you begin the book by talking about the Concow Native tribe, the original inhabitants of the area. And you write that you were struck by how the Concow legend offered a remarkable glimpse into the past of what tribal ancestors had witnessed long before white settlers arrived and displaced them. Before housing developments were carved into sacred land, the legend illustrates the cyclical nature of wildfires and suggests how we can better adapt as the climate changes. This is starting to get finally, a lot more attention about how the natives have, you know, managed fire for thousands of years rather than fighting it as the settlers did. Tell us what you learned when you met a couple who were Concow at an event you were at. And then what do you think it's going to take to bring more natives, because some are involved at this time, but to bring more natives into the decision-making process?
Mm-hmm. So I was on a tour of the campfire burn zone back in 2019. It was a few months after the campfire had ignited. And I remember we were standing on this plateau looking down at the community of Concow, which is only a few miles away from Paradise, and everything was just completely burned. And then this couple offered to share this legend from their tribe. And there is something about hearing this story about how fire belongs on the landscape and how in the past another really big fire had come through and basically wiped out a community as we were standing on land that had recently burned. And it really struck me that that's the kind of story that, you know, you just don't hear that often, because it just has gotten wiped from our history books in so many different ways. So I knew I really wanted to include it in the book and help explain the fact, the way that we've been managing land, it could change. That sense that fire is an evil thing, that's not true, that fire is a really natural part of the landscape. And we sort of created this problem for ourselves in a lot of ways by stomping it off of the landscape altogether. And so that's why we're seeing so many of these really big, vicious fires nowadays that are acting in ways that we haven't seen in the past. Obviously, that's also exacerbated by climate change and where we're building. But I think there is something we could learn by looking back to Indigenous people's cultivation of the land and how they lived on it.
And as you write, and I appreciate the history, I think this is so important, and I hope listeners can read the book because Lizzie does really go into some important history here. The Concow Band of the Maidu tribe were the first to call this area home. The indigenous group ignited small grass fires to clear brush. And just a little bit of history, after the gold rush thrust California into statehood in 1850, stoking even greater dreams of easy wealth, the native population was slaughtered by the newcomers through malaria and smallpox or outright genocide. Within 2 years of the gold rush, 100,000 had died. Much of the killing was state-sponsored, with indigenous groups enslaved over petty offenses or forced into indentured servitude. Within 20 years, 80% of California's total native population had vanished. In 1863, the 461 surviving Concows were marched 90 miles west to the Round Valley Reservation. Only half of them survived the journey called the Concow Trail of Tears. Again, Lizzie, thank you for including this history. It's so important. Just tell us a little bit more about what else you learned about this history and why you think it's important to include in this book.
Yeah, you know, like I was mentioning earlier, I think that prehistory is something that so often gets left out. We have history books that were written from a very European-centric point of view. And so when those settlers came over, they very much saw fire as evil and something that needed to be stomped out. They saw forests as this economic thing, and if fire came through and burned down trees, they couldn't make money off of it. So all of those really important lessons started to disappear. People just weren't listening to them. And so I think now people are finally starting to pay attention and realize that preventative burning and all of the work that's done before fire season arrives is really important. And there is something that we can learn from indigenous groups like the Concow and what they did for so much time before we altered the landscape in a way that helped lead to the crisis that we're living in now.
Do you feel like this is finally getting more attention, but do you think that anything will change as a result based on the people you interviewed?
Yeah, you know, it's hard. It's hard because we're still trying to come up with solutions at this point. I think that the past few years have really been a reckoning for the people of California, for policymakers, understanding that these fires are getting worse and worse and they aren't going to go away. And we're going to need to start changing the way that we're making decisions. But it's not really something that you can change overnight. This is the legacy that we're living with, our suppression of fire on the landscape. And so even though there's been more support recently for preventative burning, it still is tough for people to totally get behind because fire can be scary and people don't like seeing smoke in the sky in February. But I think more and more there's support in realizing that that's the kind of thing that could prevent a big fire from totally decimating a community.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Kim in Hayward. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for this program. So I'm just thinking that we need to also think preventively when we're thinking about our buildings and our houses, and we need to incorporate the protections from fire when we start building new communities. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we need to take into consideration because it's up to us now, because this is a constant, you know, problem that we're going to be having with the climate change.
Yeah, it's a great comment, and thank you for calling in, Kim. Lizzie, have you had a chance to see the new documentary called Bring Your Own Brigade by Lucy Walker?
You know, I saw it came out, but I haven't watched it yet. Have you? What's it
yeah,
like?
Yes, we actually had her on recently, and it was such an interesting experience to see her film and then read your book, because it really you really complement each other. And I just wanted to ask you, connected to Kim's question about building codes, we see a town hall meeting in Paradise with council members, and they're asking the community of Paradise to take building code measures for fire-safe homes. These are proven steps to ensure that something like this does not happen again, including like a 5-foot barrier, 5 feet of space around the home. This makes a huge, huge difference. And the fire chief came in and talked to the community about this. And because so many people pride themselves on, you know, being libertarian in that community, they basically said, we don't want people telling us what to do. And one by one, the city council members voted no on these basic changes. And they told the filmmaker, Lucy, that they wanted to vote yes, but they voted no because of pressure from the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard for people because it does require time and effort and money to make a community more fire safe, but we're losing that privilege, right? Of just assuming that we can continue to build in the ways that we have built in the past and that will be fine. And so that is a grave disservice to the future of the town. We've learned that these fires are likely to strike the same areas over and over again. It's not coincidence. If you look at the 2017 Tubbs fire, that area that burned also burned in 1964 in the Hanley fire. And so we do need to think about how we're building, and we do need to change that. Even if, you know, it's hard and constituents don't like it, you have to do it for their safety.
What sense did you get in talking to so many of these people? As you point out, a majority of the country's vote went to Donald Trump in 2016. You saw Make America Great Again stickers adorning many, many bumpers in the area. And so you've got people hearing from fire officials saying that these changes are going to make your community safer. We have to do this together. And a lot of people said Paradise is an individualistic town. We don't need conformity. So what are your thoughts on that?
It's not so simple. You know, I think that a lot of people are hesitant to just making a town that looks really uniform, like you said. And I think that, you know, there's some trauma in that too. It's hard for people to rebuild and think, oh, I need to start thinking again about my house possibly burning down a second time. I also know that rebuilding can sometimes be a luxury, and particularly for people that don't have a ton of money, it can be hard to add a bunch of fire resistant features or even rebuild at all. And so it's just, it's very complicated. I think it's easy to say, oh, it's just because the town is libertarian or just because people don't want to follow a set of rules, but it's just hard. And I think that is something we need to start talking about though more. I think that there is more that could be done in terms of how we build, because again, these fires aren't going away, and rebuilding your home in a fire safe way could be the difference in losing it a second time around.
So in terms of building back for a place like Paradise, because so many experts say that the areas that burn down are going to burn down again. I mean, these are scientists. These are fire chiefs who are saying this. So what regulations have been put in place for this community?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they did pass some rules. Like, for example, you can't have a wood fence attached to your home. You have to have venting on the attic. And the state of California actually a couple of years ago passed legislation requiring new construction to have certain fire resistant features. But again, this doesn't apply to old construction. And so across the state of California, one of the big issues right now is that you have a lot of communities that were built a long time ago, and those homes aren't required to be fire resistant, and there is no money to retrofit them. Places that are really similar to Paradise, where there's not a ton of money, there's a lot of elderly people or disabled people who are living there because it's an affordable place to live. And so I think it's really horrifying to think about the fact that the fate of paradise will likely play out in all of these other places. And something as simple as retrofitting your home could be a good way to prevent that kind of tragedy. But at the same time, you need money and support for that, and that doesn't always exist.
Today, we're speaking with Lizzie Johnson, staff writer with The Washington Post, author of the new book, Paradise, One Town Struggle to Survive an American Wildfire. Lizzie, let's spend the rest of the hour talking about PG&E. Can you first tell us what we know about how the fire ignited? It was from a malfunctioning PG&E transmission line. So tell us more about what we've learned since.
Of course. So the campfire sparked from a transmission tower that was owned by PG&E. It was tucked up in a river canyon a few miles away from the town of Paradise. And on the morning the fire ignited, there was this hook on the tower that had been whittling away for, you know, close to 100 years, records show. It had outlived every single man that helped install it. And so with the winds blowing really fiercely, the hook snapped and that high voltage transmission line fell to the ground, sprayed hot metal into the grass. And that is what started the fire. In court documents and state reports, it became really clear that that fire could have been prevented. It would have just taken the replacement of the hook. In terms of parts alone, the hook itself would have cost $19 to replace. And so it's just like awful to think about, right? Like all of those lives, all of those homes that were lost came down to one hook.
It's just so awful to think about. As you write, I mean, you have so much really important information about PG&E in your book, specifically on this case. As you write, the company announced that it would plead guilty to one count of unlawfully causing a fire and 84 counts of involuntary manslaughter. An 85th death was proven to be only indirectly related to the wildfire. A man had committed suicide rather than burned to death in his home, which in a cruel twist of fate had then survived the firestorm. I mean, that's just absolutely horrific. So tell us about what was the fallout here of PG&E saying that it would plead guilty to one count of unlawfully causing the fire and 84 counts of involuntary manslaughter?
So corporations can be charged like individuals and in about $3.5 million.
Sorry, your line is cutting out a bit. Can you repeat that last sentence?
Yeah. So in terms of criminal courts, corporations can be charged like individuals. And so in this case, PG&E was fined $3.5 million for those 85 counts. But unlike an individual, you can't send a business to jail. So that was all PG&E received. And a lot of people, particularly the victims of those families who died, didn't feel like that was sufficient for the pain and grief that they went through.
I mean, this is really amazing when you think about $3.5 million. As you point out, as PG&E was admitting its guilt, Geisha Williams, who had been the CEO of PG&E at the time of the campfire, listed her luxury Marin County home for sale. It was in Tiburon. She abruptly resigned in January 2019, banking $2.5 million worth of severance payments in cash. And then she stood to earn back upward of almost $4 million on the sale of her home, more than what PG&E had to pay for these 84 lives lost.
Right. And with that, I was just gesturing at how unfair it felt to so many people who lost everything that made up their life, who lost family members who had lost their lives. It still feels very unfair to a lot of people in Paradise. They talk about it frequently.
What happened to the money? Alicia writes in and says, I've heard that PG&E is hoarding the money earmarked for Paradise. Is this true?
Yeah, you know, I can't speak to exactly where the money is, but I think that's a question that a lot of people who have filed suits against PG&E are wondering. From what I understand, that money has been slow to come out, and, you know, it's put people who are trying to rebuild their lives in a really tough spot.
Can you talk about what else you learned about PG&E? I mean, I have so many notes in this book. We could probably have you back for an entire hour just to talk about PG&E, because you have a whole section in here about the history of crimes, and just a simple fact, more than 125,000 miles of PG&E electrical lines stretch across Central and Northern California, a distance five times the circumference of the Earth. PG&E was the powerful, largest power provider in the state, delivering electricity and natural gas to more than 16 million people. And you just go over a history of crimes in your book, Lizzie. What really stands out for you?
Yeah, so I think for a lot of people, particularly in the Bay Area, when you think of PG&E, you think of the San Bruno explosion in 2010. And that was a PG&E-caused disaster. They had a gas main that cracked and basically lit a neighborhood on fire, killed a bunch of people. And from that point on, you started hearing about PG&E in the news more and more. There were a series of fires that the utility started, the 2017 Wine Country wildfires, many of those were ignited by PG&E lines. And then, of course, the Camp Fire was caused by PG&E. Most recently, the utility submitted documents to the California Public Utilities Commission stating that it seems likely that it started the Dixie Fire, which again is burning up near Butte County, started not far from where the Camp Fire did. And so every summer, it seems like you're hearing about PG&E causing a new fire.
You write that the California Public Utilities Commission, known as the CPUC, was tasked with supervising the state's investor-owned electric and gas utilities. The commission was an economic regulator, not a safety enforcer, and it struggled to oversee all of the entities like Lyft and Uber, but particularly PG&E, which was essentially a monopoly, too big, too many resources. And the wall between them was perforated with revolving doors. Employees left the CPUC to work for PG&E or as lobbyists on the company's behalf, helping to write the laws that governed them. PG&E was a top political donor in Sacramento, shelling out $5.3 million to campaigns in 2017 and 2018. You write, the relationship was so inappropriate that the utility paid nearly $100 million in fines following the San Bruno explosion for communications that violated state law. But even though all of this came out, PG&E failed to change and people continue to die because of its negligence. So is it just the revolving door? I mean, what did people tell you during your research?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big question that I always get and that I wish I had an answer to, but you know, I don't, because I'm just a journalist trying to show what the problems look like. But the question is, you know, what do you do about PG&E? It's tough because you can't just force the company out of business because Californians need electricity, they need gas. But we're also in a situation where, again, every summer it seems like PG&E is found responsible for starting another wildfire. You hear in their probationary court, the judge going on and on about what to do, how to make PG&E more responsible. And I think it's just something that, you know, we're going to see play out over time. This is a company that followed the run to failure approach for a very long time, prioritizing profit over maintaining its lines. And so that's sort of a legacy we're living with right now, too, not dissimilar to our legacy of stomping fire off the landscape.
What can we expect, do you think, in the next year? Because we know this has already happened, that PG&E has implemented these rolling blackouts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the blackouts, you know, are here to stay. It's a tough thing because it's hard to know exactly what they prevent. It's very inconvenient to a lot of people. It's an imperfect solution. You hear a lot of talk about delicate medical equipment being interrupted, people not being able to charge their phones or having to live with noisy generators. But at the same time, that's better than a massive wildfire starting. So I think that that's something we're going to continue to have to live with as PG&E figures out how to harden its infrastructure and how to strengthen a system that is built on really fire-prone land.
Can you, in our remaining minutes, talk about reporting on PG&E? Do you think that the company will receive more scrutiny from the media? I remember meeting with an old editor at the San Francisco Bay Guardian, and he said, we had PG&E on our radar, and we feel like the rest of the media really missed the boat. This was a while ago, because PG&E is so incredibly powerful. So yeah. Do you think more reporters are going to really shine a spotlight on this company?
Yeah, you know, I think in the past few years, that has been happening. There are some incredible reporters at the San Francisco Chronicle, KQED. The Wall Street Journal has done a lot of reporting on PG&E. I think that it's gotten a little easier to understand the company because they have been in the courts so often, and there are things that come out in public documents that you just couldn't get before because it was a private company. So I think we'll start learning more and more about PG&E.
And Lizzie, we have about 2 minutes left. When you talk about what needs to change in the future as we're dealing with so many devastating fires in California and across the West, what stood out for you based on the various experts you interviewed?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the biggest things is we just need to get on the same page in terms of understanding that climate change is here and that it's really impacting the way that these wildfires act, that this isn't something that we can just push off and deal with in 10 years. It's something that we're dealing with now. And so part of that is really thinking about where we are building in this state and how we are building, particularly for new developments, whether it's a wise thing to put a brand new neighborhood deep in a fire-prone forest, as well as, you know, what to do with the electrical grid, how to strengthen it, our own personal preparedness, getting ready for fires, making sure that we have a plan if they do strike. And also, you know, just realizing again that this is our reality now and we can't ignore it. And so having those conversations is the first place to start when figuring out what those solutions might be.
Lizzie Johnson is a staff writer at the Washington Post who previously worked at the San Francisco Chronicle. She's the author of the new book, Paradise, One Town's Struggle to Survive an American Wildfire. Lizzie, thank you so much for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you. You can find more information about Lizzie's book and her work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering our show. And I hope you can join us tomorrow. We will speak with Afghans in the U.S. about what's at stake for their families and their country. At least 12,000 Afghans have been evacuated, and so many more say they have to flee because of their safety. So we will share resources about how to help families fleeing Afghanistan. We'll also find out where they are going and just what it is like to actually resettle. We hope you can join us tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.